Good evening, it's Saturday, September 19th, 2020. Coming up, people across the country mourn the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
We should mourn the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we should not allow the attempts of McConnell and Trump to replace her with the fascist nominee.
In Pakistan, many are speaking out against the senior police officer who said a woman who was gang raped in front of her children was partially responsible for what happened to her for choosing to drive at night without a male.
You know, when we blame the victim and say, oh, where's their common sense? Well, where is your sense of duty when your job is to protect the citizens and you are blaming?
And protesters continue to pressure the Kentucky Attorney General to hold the officers involved with the shooting of Breonna Taylor accountable.
Though there's a record settlement plus police reforms, please don't think that that means justice for Breonna Taylor.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. Refuse Fascism will be taking to the streets in cities across the country on Monday to draw attention to the 200,000 COVID-related deaths in the United States. Friday's sobering news of the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has prompted Refuse Fascism to extend the scope of their planned actions across the country. Barry Thornton is a spokesperson for the Bay Area branch of Refuse Fascism.
I mean, this moment is a very heavy moment that we should mourn the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we should not allow the attempts of McConnell and Trump to replace her with the fascist nominee, which they've already announced they're doing.
You originally had a protest planned for Monday marking the crisis around COVID and saying now that there's 200,000 deaths that we know of related to COVID, and now you've shifted your focus in light of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. Talk about why that was really important and what her death signifies to you and for this movement of justice that you work to promote every week.
She's been a monumental figure on the Supreme Court, and her everyone who supports the rights of women in particular and who opposes fascism should mourn and commemorate her death. And everyone is taking very sober account of what this regime has been doing, what they want to do with her death. They want to put an anti-abortion justice in there. We know that, and we have to find the strength to turn this loss into its opposite and rally and gather further strength to do what we've got to do, which is take to the streets. Just as a basic question of morality, there is right and wrong. There is standing with the interests of humanity, and you have to do that. Not because it's popular, not because gonna work on Tuesday. You have to do it because it's right. And then, yes, you have to fight to bring people along and actually change the world. But you have to take a stand on the right side of things. And that it's really important that people do that and understand things in that way. And because this is a time when people need to stand up to very powerful and extremely dangerous forces. And all this is sort of thrown before us, whether we're ready for it or not. Here we are, you know. So that and that's probably what her death sort of brings home to people is, oh my God, here we are. You know, what are we going to do?
How do you feel like you'll carry her legacy forward in the work that you're doing? Thornton says Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life exemplifies the importance of living on the right side of history.
In one way, I feel like a Supreme Court justice is, you know, very far from the work I do. But in another sense, and again, particularly right now in this very fraught moment, we have to have really big arms and embrace people far across the political spectrum who see and sense that what's at stake in this moment and want to do the right thing. And she certainly did that in her way, and was a very important figure at this time in history.
For information about the local and national protests planned for Monday, visit refusefascism.org.
Trade has been a big issue in recent presidential elections. Donald Trump was able to win the 2016 election in part because of his promises to blue-collar workers in swing states to renegotiate trade deals and bring back manufacturing jobs. Lori Wallach is the head of the Global Trade Watch Division of Public Citizen. She talked about trade agreements, manufacturing jobs, and President Trump's record on bringing jobs back to the U.S.
trade agreements have provisions in them that undermine access to affordable medicines, that make it hard to break up the big tech platforms, that undermine the kinds of policies we need to tackle the climate crisis. And so the issue ends up also coming up in the context of, will candidates be honest? And for instance, when they all run around saying, I'm going to improve, buy America, we're going to reinvest our tax dollars to innovate and create green jobs at home, if they don't also say, and I'm going to fix the trade agreement provisions that forbid that, then they're not actually able to deliver and they're not being sincere.
So President Trump has said from time to time that he's brought back a bunch of manufacturing jobs, and sometimes he'll go to a town and he'll say, look, there's this new tractor factory or this new auto plant. And so how many jobs has he brought back?
So the net situation with manufacturing jobs is that we are basically at a wash. What happened was in the last 2.5 years of the Obama administration and the first 2.5 years of the Trump administration, there was a pretty steady trajectory of manufacturing job growth. And you can measure sort of the health of the manufacturing industry through a thing called the Purchasing Managers Index, which gives you sort of a forward look at what inputs manufacturing companies are purchasing. And if it's 50% or above, it's a growth situation. And it's been a growth situation basically from 2.5 years before Trump came to office through the first 2.5 years of his presidency. But well before COVID, in the middle of 2019, things started to flatten. And in fact, that Purchasing Managers Index went negative. This is before COVID. Now, obviously, since COVID, there's been horrific job loss, 700,000 manufacturing jobs right now. People are furloughed. It's unclear if their jobs are going to come back. And, you know, Trump keeps saying he's brought these jobs back, but the reality is he promised to end job outsourcing. And his own Department of Labor has certified 300,000 additional jobs lost to trade in the first 3 years of his presidency. So on the merits of his own promise, no more outsourcing, that did not come to fruition. But also his promises brought back so many manufacturing jobs and things are booming. In fact, the data show we're at a wash, basically, from when he started the presidency. And moreover, in some states, there's a net loss.
That's Lori Wallach of Public Citizen.
Daniel Cameron, do your job!
Some 100 protesters gathered outside the home of Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron to demand justice for Breonna Taylor. This week, the city of Louisville, Kentucky agreed to a $12 million settlement with the family of Breonna Taylor, along with a number of police reforms, including efforts to have police live and do community service in the areas they serve. But protesters say that until the officers involved in the shooting are held responsible, that is not enough. Cynthia Ganote is a gender sociologist at the University of Louisville and has been among the protesters demanding justice for Breonna Taylor.
Protesters yesterday said, please don't think that this settlement, though there's a record settlement plus police reforms, please don't think that that means justice for Breonna Taylor. So yesterday, Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, led, along with a group called Until Freedom, and a number of other Kentucky protesters and groups, were there at Cameron's office outside, chanting and demanding that his report be delivered, that justice be served, and that that should come in the form of arresting and charging the officers who are responsible for the murder of Breonna Taylor.
Ganote says people should be aware of the relationship between Daniel Cameron and United States Senator Mitch McConnell and the conflicting priorities that are becoming evident in the aftermath of the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Daniel Cameron, who is Kentucky's Attorney General, was legal counsel for Mitch McConnell. Daniel Cameron is, quote unquote, Mitch's guy. He very much responds to whatever Mitch McConnell wants to happen in policy, in practice, in politics, in ways formal and informal. So being at Daniel Cameron's office yesterday and knowing how many days it's been since this criminal investigation has been going on and still no word and still no justice for Breonna Taylor. And then last night, reading the statement from Mitch McConnell upon the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and hearing that Mitch McConnell plans to rush through a decision on appointing a justice to the Supreme Court. He can make that happen in a flash. But Daniel Cameron, who is Mitch's guy and who is doing Mitch's will, can't get this criminal investigation material out for the public in the case of justice for Breonna Taylor. I find it to be linked in the most direct of ways, and I find it to be deplorable.
Ganote says that until members of the Louisville Police Department are held accountable, protesters are not going away.
Since the murder of George Floyd, Louisville activists have been out in the streets, collectively raising their voices to demand justice for Breonna Taylor, and they hold up the names of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and every other person who's been tragically murdered. So Louisville, Kentucky is very much in this fight. There is no end in sight to people raising their voices and demanding justice.
That's Cynthia Ganote, a gender sociologist from the University of Louisville.
The agreement establishing formal relations between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain is being touted by some as a great breakthrough in Israeli-Arab relations, but not everyone is happy with the deal, least of all Palestinians. Huwaida Araf is a Palestinian-American human rights lawyer based in Detroit who helped organize a protest against the agreement outside the White House this week. She talked about the protest and the agreement.
We were very much impressed and grateful that we got over 50 organizations to sign on to our statement in opposition to this normalization deal, because while it's being presented as some kind of advancement for peace, it is anything but. Palestinians were obviously left out of it. Palestinians oppose it wholeheartedly, and Palestinians are the people that are going to be suffering because of it, because while they claim to be trying to advance peace, the Palestinian people are still living under brutal Israeli occupation, apartheid, and colonization. And Israel hasn't stopped for 1 minute colonizing Palestinian land and traumatizing the people. And so without freedom for Palestine, there can be no true peace. So this is basically a farce. And this whole charade that took place at the White House was absent of any Palestinian representation.
From what I recall, the Israelis were making a much bigger deal about it than the UAE. That for the Israelis, it was a significant breakthrough. For the UAE, they were kind of playing it down. Is that still true?
Well, it would make absolute sense, because Israel is trying to project to the world that it is a normal state that should have open relations, and that having open relations with these Arab states benefits Israel. That way they can ignore the pleas and the demands of the Palestinian people to be free. And whereas previously the offer of the organization of Arab states was peace in exchange for Israel ending its occupation of Palestine and of Arab lands. And Israel rejected that outright. And now we have two Arab states that have outright decided to publicly normalize with Israel in exchange for nothing. So obviously this is good for Israel. As far as for these Arab countries, for the UAE and for Bahrain, of course they want to play it down, because most of their people, the Arab people, still stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And it's pretty shameful that they've decided to normalize with a colonial state at the expense of the Palestinian people.
That's human rights attorney Huwaida Araf.
You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. People across the country of Pakistan are speaking out against a top police official in the aftermath of his victim-blaming statements about a woman who was gang-raped in front of her children while traveling on a motorway leading to the eastern city of Lahore. S.S. Masoof is a Pakistani-American activist.
This event happened on September 9th, and this woman, with her two children, she ran out of gasoline on the major highway. Like I said, it's the biggest project and a very well-kept and highway. The next day, the most senior police official in the Lahore area, his name is Omar Sheikh, he appeared in front of media and implied that she was partly to be blamed for this. The outcry on social media has put him in a very uncompromising position.
Talk about kind of the public message or the public outcry that you're talking about after he made the statements that she was partially to be blamed because she had the audacity to be out with her children after dark without a male in the car.
The Pakistani society as a whole has evolved and has a very strong liberal media, as well as activists, feminist activists, people proclaiming social justice issues, evangelizing equality, all these things. And, you know, when they hear something like that, there was a huge public outcry.
Masouf says there are some concerning parallels he's seeing between the blaming the victim cultures in both the United States and Pakistan. Masouf says there are some concerning parallels he's seeing between the blaming the victim cultures in both the United States and Pakistan.
This is exactly the kind of Trump messaging we see in the U.S., right? You blame the victim. Why were they out there, right? And this is, unfortunately, the way our society is moving forward. And with these fringe right-wing elements who first blame the victim. We've seen this in police shootings here. You know, the right always goes after that. No, what were they doing there? Why were they not coming out of the car? What was she doing on the road? So I think it's this mentality that we have to struggle to, you know, put in perspective. And that's the big learning we have to come out from this or any other situation happening all over the world.
That's S.S. Masouf, a Pakistani-American activist.
Canada is not particularly known for its anti-Semitism or far-right politics, but the phenomenon does exist there. KPFA spoke with freelance writer and author Lev Golinkin about the far-right in Canada and elsewhere.
Well, with Canada, there is certainly a lot of neo-Nazi activity happening there, but you could say the same thing about the United States. So, I mean, I wouldn't classify it as, you know, being Berlin 1933, certainly, but there is a rise in far right. Much more disturbingly, just as in the United States, Canada's far right is starting to interact and coordinate with neo-Nazis across the Atlantic. And that is a very dangerous thing. Because in other words, think about ISIS and how they would use recruits and they wouldn't just be based in one area. And it's the same thing happening here, where suddenly white supremacists see themselves not as soldiers for Canada or soldiers for the US, but soldiers in a global war. They don't see themselves as lone wolves. They see themselves as fighting for the survival of the white race. And what that means is they are starting to communicate across borders. They're starting to share training. They're starting to share information. They're starting to help each other radicalize. And that is a particularly dangerous thing because it is a phenomenon that we should now start looking at as international or rather as transnational.
So I take it they're not just directing their hostility towards Jews, but against immigrants, say Muslim immigrants and other non-whites. Is that true?
What they're looking at is they have an existential fear of being wiped out, of being bred out, of becoming minority-majority nations in Canada, the U.S., in Europe, and in Australia and New Zealand. And when they say things like white genocide, in their own minds, they actually feel that. And these people glorify slavers, they glorify Nazis, they glorify people who did exterminate others. So this is their mindset. This is how they look at the world. So now they're...
Well, it's a real dog-eat-dog, survival of the fittest. If they win, we lose kind of thing?
If they win, we will not just be tossed on the ash heap of history. We will be dismantled. Just as for so many centuries, people who conquered the United States and Canada have pretty much almost succeeded in dismantling the Native American cultures, traditions, languages in so many ways. So that's what the white supremacists of today fear.
That's freelance writer Lev Golinkin.
Today in Oakland, organizations in collaboration with public nonprofits and private organizations staged a car caravan for universal basic income, starting at East Shore Park at the corner of MacArthur Boulevard and Grand Avenue. This caravan was part of a nationwide campaign for universal basic income in over 35 cities. KPFA's Diana Kapkaban reports.
The idea of a universal basic income, or UBI, was popularized by former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang during televised debates. Yang described this program as a key component of his campaign raising the issue on the national level. With the absence of a federal economic stimulus, which would put cash in the hands of millions of struggling Americans to stimulate the economy, UBI advocates say there are alternative ways of combating poverty. They say the UBI at the local or state government levels can be initiated in collaboration with private and philanthropic donors. Dutch historian and author of Humankind and Utopia for Realists, Rutger Bergman, defines basic income as a right as a citizen to unconditional money or a cash transfer from the government. Bergman describes what UBI had done.
What researchers have shown time and time and again by comparing a test group of four people who received free money and another control group who was similar so that they could see what the effects would be. Time and time again, they have shown that free money results in, well, lower inequality, lower poverty, obviously, but it also results in less infant mortality, lower healthcare costs, lower crime rates, better school completion records, less truancy, higher economic growth, better emancipation rates, and all kinds of other positive social outcomes.
Former Labor Secretary and Public Policy Professor Robert Reich says that currently 57% of Americans don't have enough cash on hand to cover $500 unforeseen expenses. He says a cost of living refund, also called a working families credit, puts more money back in the pockets of working and middle class people who need it most. Universal basic income advocates say UBI would help working families face the rising costs of living and housing and give them a leg up out of poverty or a cushion of financial stability. They also say it builds on a high minimum wage so workers earn enough to live on. Opponents argue it would disparage people from looking for work. In a TED talk on UBI, Rutger Bergman gives an example of a UBI experiment by a local charity in London in 2009, where 13 chronically homeless men were given a basic income. Over time, here is what the outcome was.
What happened in the first place is that the men turned out to be extremely frugal with the money they received. At the end of the first year, only £800 had been spent on average. And where did they spend it on? Well, a phone, or a passport, or a dictionary. Each of the men had his own idea of what would be best for him. Moreover, a year after the experiment had started, the impossible had happened. 7 out of 13 of the men had a roof above their head. 2 more had applied for housing. Some of the men took gardening classes. Another learned how to cook, for example. And all of the men made plans for the future. It sort of seemed as if the cash had empowered them.
There are many examples of how countries affected by the coronavirus have implemented universal basic income by directing money to their citizens to lighten the economic blow. These countries include China, France, Japan, Canada, Namibia, Finland, and Germany. In California, several mayors, including those in Stockton, Oakland, and Compton, are studying ways to implement a universal basic income program.
As the national election gets closer, there's been a lot of fervor around the two nominees, the voting process, and most importantly, the role of democracy in a modern society. The First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco organized an online forum today featuring veteran San Francisco reporter Tim Redmond. KPFA's Lola Kamu reports.
The presidential elections is on everyone's mind, and the recent passing of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg adds to the growing urgency for a change in leadership. According to the latest public polls, more than half of all Americans disapprove of the president, especially his handling of the coronavirus. The First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco is a sanctuary for people of many faiths and directs its resources towards religious, educational, and humanitarian purposes. The congregants of the society held a forum today to discuss the crucial issues of the national and San Francisco elections with San Francisco investigative reporter Tim Redmond. Redmond was the executive editor of the Bay Guardian and now runs 48hills.org blog. Redmond says there is a serious wealth gap in the U.S. and that taxing the rich is the only way to restore balance.
First of all, by restoring income taxes to the level that they were between 1946 and 1980. In that period, the richest people paid up to 80% of their marginal income in income taxes. This did two things. One, it brought in a lot of money. But two, it redistributed income so that there weren't a lot of very rich people and there were fewer really poor people. When I was a kid, there were exactly three billionaires in the United States of America. It was John Paul Getty, Howard Hughes, and the Rockefeller family. Now we have, I think, something like 25 billionaires just in San Francisco. We even adjust for inflation, it's incredible. So that's the one thing. We need to restore the marginal tax rates to what they were in the post-war era.
Redman says he encourages people to mail in their ballot votes early.
I'm also encouraging people, no matter where you are, if you vote by mail, which many of us are going to do, in California, everyone's going to get a vote by mail ballot, and probably for the first time since 1984. So if you vote by mail, everyone should mail in their ballot the day they get it. Because I think Trump, when we've already seen cutbacks in the Postal Service, and I think Trump is going to secretly do more. I think he's going to mess with the Postal Service to try to get ballots delayed so they don't arrive until after Election Day and can't be counted. So I'm encouraging everyone, get that ballot, and I think we should all do that as early as possible.
Again, that was Tim Redman with 48ills.org. Dolores Perez Heilbrun is with the Unitarian Universalist Society. She says that she hopes that people can stay informed and learn about the various issues before the election.
Well, I think they're very serious because of the unusual circumstances the American people are confronted with the coming elections. And we want to make sure that it's a democratic process. There have been all sorts of threats and wild stories about how the voting is going to go. We encourage everybody to vote, of course, and participate in this process and try not to be influenced by some of the false information that's floating around.
The church will be holding a rally on Monday at 3 p.m. on 7th and Mission to march against fascism and honor Ruth Bader Ginsburg and those who have died from the coronavirus. To learn more, you can visit their website at uusf.org. Reporting for KPFA News, I'm Lola Como.
On Sunday evening, there will be a vigil to honor the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in front of the Walnut Creek City Hall at 6 p.m. And the weather in the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the 50s, sunny tomorrow with highs in the 90s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the 60s tonight, sunny with highs in the upper 80s tomorrow. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Lola Okamu and Diana Kapkaban for helping to prepare tonight's news. Carla West is at the controls. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.